You're listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. In her introduction to her anthology, Veterans of War, Veterans of Peace, the writer Maxine Hong Kingston discusses the premise of the veterans writing groups that she's hosted for, I don't know, the past several decades. That motto is, tell the truth and so make peace. Before veterans read their work to each other in Maxine's workshops, and we did the same thing here in our veterans writing group, she evokes Avalokiteshvara, the bodhisattva of compassionate listening. And we say, we aspire to learn your way of listening in order to relieve the suffering of the world. So that is the spirit that I suggest we all listen with tonight as we listen to Brian Turner's powerful poetry. Brian Turner is a veteran of 7 years service in the U.S. Army, which included 1 year as an infantry team leader in Iraq. Prior to that, he was deployed to Bosnia-Herzegovina. His debut book, Hear Bullet, won many prizes, including the 2005 Beatrice Holly Award, and he was also awarded the Amy Lowell Traveling Fellowship and a fellowship from the Lannan Foundation. And I'm sure many of you might have seen some of Brian's blogs on the New York Times Opinionator page. He wrote some very interesting pieces, which maybe he can talk about tonight. In the review of his first book, the New York Times reviewer wrote, "The day of the first moonwalk, my father's college literature professor told his class, someday they'll send a poet and we'll find out what it's really like. Turner has sent back a dispatch from a place arguably more incomprehensible than the moon, the war in Iraq, and deserves our thanks." Brian Turner's recent book of poems, Phantom Noise, continues his exploration of the aftermath of war. These poems illuminate the experience of combat and homecoming with vivid imagery, with lyricism, and with compassion. Brian Turner tells the truth of his experience and so makes peace. I am so pleased to welcome Brian Turner to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
Each night is different. Each night the same. Sometimes I pull the trigger, sometimes I don't. When I pull the trigger, he often just stands there gesturing as if saying, "Aren't you ashamed?" When I don't, he douses himself in gasoline, drowns himself in fire. A dog barks in the night's illuminated green landscape, and the platoon sergeant orders me to shoot it. Some nights, I twitch and jerk in my sleep. My lover has learned to face away. She closes her eyes when I fuck her. I imagine she's far away, and we don't use the word love. When she sleeps, helicopters come in low over the date palms. Men are bound on their knees, shivering in the animal stall long before dawn. I whisper into their ears, saying, howl wind," meaning mortars, mortars. "Howl wind, motherfucker, howl wind." The milk cow stares with its huge brown eyes. The milk cow wants to know how I can do this to another human being. I check the haystack in the corner for a weapons cache. I check the sewage sump. I tell no one, but sometimes late at night, I uncover rifles and bullets within me. Other nights, I drive through Baghdad, Fireball, Bakersfield, Kettleman City. Some nights, I'm up in the hatch shooting a controlled pair into someone's radiator. Some nights, I hear a woman screaming. Others, I shoot the crashing car. When the boy brings us a platter of fruit, I mistake cantaloupe for a human skull. Sometimes, the gunman fires into the house. Sometimes the gunman fires at me. Every night it's different, every night the same. Some nights I pull the trigger, and some nights I burn him alive. It's cool. I appreciate it. Thanks for letting me come out here tonight to read some poems for you, because I'm sure there are many writers in the audience as well. It's an honor that I get to sit here. Maybe next time I'll get to sit there and listen to your work as well. So I'm just going to read a bunch of poems that really kind of suck, you know? This is painful, this is painful, this is painful, this is painful, you know? It misses some of the gallows humor that accompanied it when I was in Iraq, for example, which was sort of one of the ways of getting through things, I thought. But let me, how are you guys doing tonight? Yeah? Doing all right? Yeah? Thursday night, came out to hear poetry? It's fantastic. You guys rock, man. You know? I wouldn't want to be anywhere else, you know? Thank you very much. And the only thing I would add is if my wife could be here. That would be fantastic. She's in Florida, but she's going to fly and meet me in Reno in about 3.5 days. So it'd be fantastic. So the person who showed up in that first poem, if she were here, she would want me to point out that that's not her, for example. if you read this book at the end, there's a poem called In the Guggenheim Museum, and she might say, though, she might blush, and I'm Irish, so I always look red, but she would blush, and you would know she's blushing, and then that is her in the end, so you can see for yourself. This poem is called At Lowe's Home Improvement Center. Standing in aisle 16, the hammer and anchor aisle, I bust a 50-pound box of double-headed nails open by accident. They're oily, bright shanks and diamond points like firing pins from M4s and M16s. In a steady stream, they pour onto the tile floor, constant as shells falling south of Baghdad last night, where Bosch kneeled under the chain guns of helicopters stationed above, their tracer fire a synaptic geometry of light. I hope they're okay. At dawn, when the shelling finally stops, hundreds of bandages will not be enough. Maybe the next time you hear a siren, you might think, maybe there are sirens in Baghdad as well. Maybe they're Red Crescents, ambulances, going to help someone. Maybe there really is a country called Iraq. You know, how many people have died in Iraq?
A lot.
A lot, yeah. How many did the last administration, our administration, say?
7,000.
Didn't it get bumped up to 100? Right, but I mean, what was admitted by the administration? Like, okay, this is what we'll say. Yeah. In this one particular battle, this was from an email that Bosch sent to me, my old rifleman. He went back and he said, at dawn, when the shelling finally stops, this one incident, hundreds of bandages will not be enough. And the poem goes on, I'll go on, but he said to me, he said, and the American side, not a scratch. Which is the way it feels here too, doesn't it? Sometimes, if you don't have someone in your family you've lost. Bosch walks down aisle 16 now, in full combat gear, improbable, worn out from fatigue, a rifle slung at his side, his left hand guiding a 10-year-old boy who has seen what war is and will never rid it from his head. Here, Bosch says, take care of him. I'm going back in for more. Sheets of plywood drop with the airy breath of mortars the moment they crack open in shrapnel. Mower blades are just mower blades, and the Troy-built self-propelled mower doesn't resemble a Blackhawk or an Apache. In fact, no one seems to notice the Casualty Collection Center Dachheim marks out in ceiling fans, aisle 15. Wounded Iraqis with IVs sit propped against boxes as 92 sample Paradiso fans hover in a slow revolution of blades. The forklift driver over-adjusts, swinging the tines until they slice open gallons and gallons of paint, sienna dust and lemon sorbet and ship's harbor blue, pulling in the aisle where Sergeant Rampley walks through, carrying someone's blown-off arm, cradled like an infant, handing it to me, saying, hold this, Turner. We might find who it belongs to. Cash registers open and slide shut with the sound of machine guns being charged. Dead soldiers are laid out at the registers on the black conveyor belts, and the people in line still reach for their wallets. Should I stand at the magazine rack reading Landscaping with Stone or the Complete Home Improvement Repair Book? What difference does it make if I choose tumbled travertine tile or Botticini marble or black absolute granite? Outside, palm trees line the asphalt boulevards. Restaurants cool their patrons who will enjoy fireworks exploding over Bass Lake in July. But inside, aisle number 7 is a corridor of lights. Each dead Iraqi walks amazed by Tiffany posts and Bavarian pole lights. Motion-activated incandescents switch on as they pass by, reverent sentinels of light, welcoming them to Lowe's Home Improvement Center, aisle number 7, where I stand in mute shock, someone's arm cradled in my own, the Iraqi boy beside me reaching down to slide his fingertip in retro-colonial blue and interior latex before writing T for tourniquet on my forehead. So I ask you, could we be bleeding? But we don't even know it. You know? I'd like to You very kindly gave me some poems that, as suggestions for tonight, so it's kind of fun. I'll try some out. There's some poems that I don't think I've ever read to anybody out loud. I've read them to myself out loud, mostly down in Texas. I was writing a lot of these poems in Marfa, Texas, about an hour north of the border with Mexico, where there's another war going on. I mean, a real, real fucking war going on down there, you know? I have to use that word because, I mean, that's what's going on down there. But up here, I say up here. This isn't that far from it either. But you get up to Reno and Lake Tahoe and you sort of, you know, Incline Village is where I'm at right now. Really nice school called Sierra Nevada College. But it's sort of it's a tourist ski town in the winter. And then in the summertime, it's a, you know, boating kind of town. Go swimming, take pictures and stuff of the beautiful lake. But there's still two cultures there. There's sort of the wealthy that are enjoying their lifestyle. And then there are the Hispanic community there, which is sort of this invisible community that sort of disappears and shows up at different times and is overlooked by the powerful part of the culture. I don't know, it's intriguing. It seems connected somehow to the border. I'm not sure. So you guys, now are you disappointed? Like, Jesus, this guy's just going to talk all the time. He's supposed to read some poems, man. This poem is called 22 Caliber. It's a Saturday. My father out in the garage with a ball-peen hammer, tamping, assembling a zip gun, teaching me to clamp the small diameter pipe to form a smoothbore barrel, bracket and finishing nail as hammer and firing pin. 1981. The Soviets fight in Afghanistan. Magazine racks carry Guns and Ammo, Penthouse, Hustler, Shooting Times, and Country Magazine. It is a world filled with ballistics, armor, lethal flights of small metal rounds spinning. On the back cover of Soldier of Fortune, an armed mujahideen lying in the prone on a rocky overlook, the coupon below him promising, buy a bullet, kill a commie. Reload. I pull the hammer back to fire over and over at paper targets with their circles driven inward, an exercise in muscle memory. I am learning how to connect with the small, dark silence carried within the center of all things. Do you guys remember that? Did you ever see that? You saw that? I saw you shaking your head. Do you remember seeing that Soldier Fortune magazine on the back cover? I was probably 12, maybe. And, I guess 1981, however old it was at that time. On the back cover, I saw you shake your head. That's why I was like, you know, you're like, what's that? Do you? I don't know if you saw that particular issue, and there were a couple issues that did it. If you flipped over on the back cover, it had this picture of this mujahideen in the prone overlooking, you know, the Soviets off in the distance. I don't remember actually seeing the Soviets in the picture, but I remember that was the idea, right? And it had, you could cut out, you know, the little dash lines where you cut out the coupon, and you could send in a buck to help, you know, help those guys buy some bullets and kill one of those commies. Buy a bullet, kill a commie. That's what it said. Man, that's our country, you know? This is a poem called Green Alexandrian, which I've been trying to write for years, and I still don't think I have it right, but I'll read this one and see what you think. Maybe you guys have ideas afterwards. Do you ever have stories or poems you've rewritten, and you keep trying it, maybe in different permutations? This is that poem for me. It's called Green Alexandrian. And there's a blue Alexandrian in T.R. Hummer's amazing book, Walt Whitman and Hell. So I recommend that. At Divisadero and Olive, the squad cars haven't arrived. They're still blocks away with sirens switched on, the radio traffic announcing codes of trauma, one vehicle, injuries unknown. Why stand here amazed at the intersection of pain? The traffic backed up in all directions, a thin haze of exhaust drifting over the scene where a Plymouth revs its engine, the wheel hub stripped on the driver's side, scorching the asphalt as sparks pinwheel out as if from the hooves of a maddened bull, the car's metal hood ruckled from the grillwork, smashed into the stoplight's pole, over and over, revving the engine, the light somehow stuck on red, juicing the accelerator with the brake pad clamped down as pawn shops, moneylenders, liquor stores stand witness behind wrought iron bars. The man now in a searing kind of rage that takes a lifetime to hone into an art like this, a public spectacle, clear as my great-grandfather, Carter, beating a heifer to death with a twisted branch from an oak tree, that kind of clarity of rage, which moves a young woman to step out from her car, to walk carefully into the headlights and noise, her voice, the smallest drops of honey I tasted as a boy, saying with her soft words, "Are you all right? which is what she did. I didn't have to make that up, you know? Can you imagine that? That was in Fresno. In Fresno, if you ever happen to be driving through, you get off the freeway on 41, right? If you happen to pull over at Fresno Street and Shaw Avenue, which is a major street in the town, right off the freeway, you can still see the dent in the stoplights pole where this guy did it. I had stopped my car because I couldn't pull any further forward. The traffic was backed up in every direction. There was a haze over the intersection. And there's now a convenience store in the parking lot, which used to just be a dirt lot. I pulled into the dirt lot with my buddy, and we looked. And I should add that I had dropped acid that night, which I don't think I told the Army about this particular story before I joined. it was years ago, you know. And I will clarify this. You can see the dent in the thing. You can see this happened. It wasn't something, a figment of my imagination. It was enhanced, but it actually happened. This guy smashed the car into this pole, and then he backed it up, and he did it again and again. The hood ruckled up. The wheel was stripped off the hub of the wheel. He would sit there holding it, juicing the accelerator, as it says in the poem, scorching the asphalt. That was the haze I was seeing. And then when she said that, she got out. She was the only one brave. I remember thinking, no, don't go out. You know, I was worried about her. And then she just sort of said, are you all right? And then it was like this weird bull thing. And he just sort of clunk, 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 and drove off down the road to who knows where. Maybe he'll come in and join us tonight, maybe. I don't know, you know? but somehow that makes me think of my great-grandfather beating a heifer to death with a branch, which was one of the sort of legends in my family of the inheritance of rage. This one, on a similar theme, seems it's called Homemade Napalm, winner of 1978. So this is before the Mujahideen and that kind of thing. We followed a recipe from the poor man's James Bond. My father mixing gasoline with bone meal and ivory soap, teaching me to shave a bar of soap with the flattened edge of the blade. My hands stung pink in the morning cold. He drank coffee, saying nothing of my grandfather, the Marine, Guadalcanal, the flamethrower carried on his back. He didn't need to. There was a thick fog that morning. He pulled the igniter and the gel burst into flame, sucking oxygen from the air, a strange kind of fire turning inward on itself. My grandfather took shots of Kentucky bourbon. My father downed a 12-pack each night. And it was hard to understand why I'd find him in the living room sometimes late, long after I'd gone to bed, waking to the sound of Josh White singing the blues in the old-time vinyl. But I began to learn. To be a man is to carry things inside no one would ever understand. Things better left unsaid. Sung about, maybe. Those rare nights in winter, alone, the world fuming with alcohol, spinning in the blue dark. Do you guys have things like that in your family? Your own lives? Yeah. I'm going to read one. I don't even think this is a poem, but it's in this book, and these are poems, so I don't know. We'll see. It says it's on. Oh, no, wait, this is a different. Oh, I see what you're saying. I'm following a set list that we worked out before, so okay, cool. This one's called Perimeter Watch. I was thinking of one at the end of the book. It was different. I locked the door tonight, checked the bolts twice just to make sure, turn off all the lights. Only the fan blades rotate above, slow as helicopters winding down their oily gears. Water buffalo chew the front lawn, snorting. When the sprinklers switch on, white cowbirds lift up from the grass with heavy wing beats, a column of feathers rising over my rooftop, their wingtips backlit by the moon. Through Venetian blinds, I see the Iraqi prisoners in that dank cell at Firebase Eagle staring back at me. They say nothing, just as they did in the winter of 2004, shivering in the piss-cold dark on scraps of cardboard, staring. Snipers traverse the skyline from the neighbor's rooftop, helicopters on station 15 minutes out. And it's difficult to tell the living from the dead, walking the dim elephant grass, papyrus thickets lining the asphalt streets. I see Bosch, my old rifleman, sleepwalking, on fire and unaware of it. I see the striker, Ghost 3, parked at the curb. I know the guys inside watch Iraqi women in the white-hot lens of the gun mount camera, eager for the smolder of their sex. A minivan idles with passengers dying inside, while down the street, an explosion sets off the neighbor's car alarm. Then, quiet. The wounded wait with great patience for Doc High, who treats them by the pool in the backyard, where I can see the Turkish cook with shrapnel on the back of his head, his mouth still foaming. Beside him, the dead infant from that cold blue morning in the orange groves of Balad, while in the pool, a battalion scout floats face down in the current. Where is my M4? My smoke grenades? My flak vest and plates of body armor? I wander the house searching for them, hear the 12-year-old voice just outside the front door. Where is my father? Let free my father. My father, no bad man. Let go, my father. When I dial 911, the operator tells me to use proper radio procedure, reminding me that my call sign is Ghost 13 Alpha, and that it's time, long past time, to unlock the door and let these people in. I guess it is a poem, right? Thank you. Thanks. I want to read one a little louder. These all seem very quiet. So. I'll read one for some Iraqi people, because I think they belong, their voice should be heard more. Actually, you have one on here, too. Page 61. You guys are very quiet. I'm not sure if you want to throw stuff at me, or if it's cool, or... this poem has a very long title, but it's called Stopping the American Infantry Patrol Near the Prophet Yunus Mosque in Mosul. Abu Ali shows them the cloth in his pocket. Do you see this weathered strip of cloth, the golden threads of its embroidery? How inconsequential it must appear to you, only a strip of cloth. But my friends, this silk and cotton dyed black, once draped over the black stone, it is from the Kiswa, and it is only with me now because my father made the long journey to the Kaaba, to the house of God, and walked the circles as the angels once circled God's throne. He kissed that black stone and ran between the hills as one must before you were even born. His pilgrimage, part of our religion, something I have not yet done. This war of no help in that, believe me. When you address me, do not call me Haji. I have not been so fortunate. And you do not understand the words you speak. Because that's one of the words that American soldiers call Iraqis. The good Iraqis, we call, oftentimes as soldiers, we would call them Hajis. Oh, the Haji. Do you see, there are a bunch of Hajis down the road. That's what they say. Bad Haji, right? Using American army lingo, a bad Haji is Alibaba. You know? You talk to little kids, but you say, hey, the little Iraqi children say, are there any Alibaba? Alibaba? Huh? And they'd be like, oh, no, and they'd laugh at each other. Oh, Alibaba, no, Alibaba, no. Alibaba, you know. What are we doing? What language, what are we, you know what I mean? It's your taxpayer dollars at work. Right? Your connection to the war, one of them. Hey, Russell, how you doing up there, man? Because I'm going to read ones a little louder, just in case, so it doesn't pop the microphone or something. Right. With that much prelude, it makes it seem really big. It's not that, yeah. For the writers out there, this poem uses 10 and 12 syllable lines because it's about a weightlifter, and he had a weight class, so I thought I should have like a kind of a restrictive kind of element put on myself. And it's called Muhammad Trains for the Beijing Olympics 2008. Do you guys remember, did you watch the Olympics at the time? Do you remember the deal with the Iraqi Olympic team? It was a kind of small team to start with, but then the Iraqi Olympic body argued bureaucratically with the International Olympic body until the team became much smaller than the original team. And Sawar Muhammad didn't get to go because of that, in part. In the 69-kilogram weight class, the Bulgarian Boevski is the world record holder. He cannot be beaten, at least not by Sawar Muhammad. Muhammad, at 26, has shoveled cement longer than he cares to remember. In Arbil, in Kurdish northern Iraq, he strains hard to lift a barbells with its heavy plates, round as the wheels of chariots. Then muscles give, and the wheels bounce in dust before him. No, he cannot defeat the Bulgarian. The problem is in lifting weight over distance. It isn't a matter of iron or of will. In Beijing, Boevski's records will go unnoticed because Muhammad is training now to lift the city of Arbil with its people. His quadriceps and posterior chain straining, the muscles tremoring to lift the Euphrates and Tigris both, mountains of the north, deserts of the west, Basra, Karbala, Ramadi, Tikrit, Mosul, 3 decades of war and the constant suffering of millions. Imagine that. Millions. This is what Sawara lives. And no matter what effort he makes, he will fail completely. And the people will love him for it. Don't you? You know? There must be millions of people like him, you know? Men and women in Iraq, like us, like here. Do you like it when a police car pulls up right behind you? Your tags are good, right? You paid your tags. They're current. You did it last month. I just got mine last week because they're going to expire by December. So I got to put them on. But I have them in the car, so I know I'm good, you know? And I re-upped my insurance for the next 3 months, so I know I'm good. My license, everything's good, you know? And I'm not some crazy driver, but still, when a cop car pulls right behind me, I'm, you know, just gonna turn up the radio a little. I don't know what it is. It's like this inherent guilt starts coming, like, oh, the authorities, I could see them in the mirrors, you know. Don't look around, don't do anything stupid, you know. But imagine like a Swedish tank, a 19-ton tank or something coming up behind you. And maybe you think that there are people that run this country that you just, you'd like them taken out of office, for example. Like I might have thought in the previous administration, for example. You know? Right, George Bush? I would say that was a mistake we made twice. Yes. I came back from Iraq in 2004. I came back just last month in 2004, right before Halloween. Right? So imagine this. I come back to this country up in Fort Lewis, Washington. Halloween hits, right? People wearing masks and crazy stuff. And then what happened the next week? You get reelected. I was like, really? Like, what? It just seemed like a disconnect to me. For those of you who voted for him, those of you with him, that's cool. That's our process. It's just my opinion, you know? We didn't even talk about this before. It was just poetry stuff, but, you know, getting a little political. That weekend, following the election, we got our first leave, and we were able to go out. And a friend of mine, Sergeant Gould, which is seen with Halloween, kind of, you know, but he said there's a rave party up in Seattle. We were in Tacoma, and so we went up there for it, right? And we go up there, it's raining, and there was a supermarket that had, you know, like the marquee letters that you see, like Safeway or whatever, Save Mart, and they were off, so you could see like the ghost impression of the letters on the building, but it's now, you know, rented out for this event. You can hear music, boom, 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 coming in, the rave music going on, right? So I pay my money at the door. There's a desk. They put a band around my wrist, and the door opens, and I walk in. The first thing I see is a 6-foot-tall pink Energizer bunny rabbit, right, with roller skates and a bass drum. Boom, 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 goes by. And I have not done acid since way back in the day, right? Just Brian, just seeing it go by, right? Okay. And as he goes by, it reveals behind him this amazing, beautiful woman who's a brunette, and she was wearing a bustier, and she had garter belts on and a thigh-high, like, wet PVC leather boots or whatever they are, you know, the ones that are all wet-looking kind of. And she's just smiling at me. It's very, I don't know, this amazing look. And she had a man by a leash who's following her, right? And he's wearing nothing but little black Speedos. And he's just sort of following after as she walks by. And I remember thinking, ah, these are my people. Yeah? But, you know, I mean, the reason I say that is because where did I just come from? I come from Iraq. And Abu Ghraib happened when I was there. And I remember the leash. And I remember the photo. And I'm thinking, ah, yes, my people. Yeah. On that note, maybe I'll switch to a different poem here. Page 51. I drove across country 2 summers ago and I wrote this poem. It's called White Phosphorus. When Larry Jr. nails a catfish to the black trunk of a black tupelo, the summer tanagers and dark-eyed juncos pause in their singing to the afternoon. And it isn't the hammer or the nail driving it in. It's the low vowel of pain stretching out over the Arkansas River and into the sway of pines. A sound that travels along Dollar Way Road and on into town, where Ray and Suzanne have forgotten how to talk with one another, steam curling over their coffee in the diner. Across the street, the old man Jackson loses his train of thought, straining to recall the year 1928. The shade tree where Uncle Harold was buried after the gas of the Argonne Forest finally took him down. It's like this at International Paper and at the county courthouse. It's like this in the back parking lot of the Duck Inn Chateau Lounge, where Marlene has finally broken down, her forehead on the steering wheel. Even in the soybean fields and poultry farms outside of town, this pause, this quiet recognition, here in Pine Bluff, Arkansas, where it's made. We can look across the curve of the globe, and we can see war that we are a part of. Sometimes it's hard to see the war that's here, where it's made. You know? We need to be reminded. I can get furious on that point, but I won't right now. Do you guys sometimes get furious about stuff like that? Well, good, because I've been going around this country for the last 5 years talking about this stuff, mostly on college campuses, not in a good, beautiful, you know, place like this. This is an amazing place. And I know that there's a lot of art and music that takes place here, so it seems like one of those places that has... it has the right thing happening here. The stage has that feel to me. But as I've gone around to many places around the country, these college campuses especially, I've been disturbed by the fact that when I graduated from high school in 1985, and then as I was going to school up in Fresno, you remember the late 80s and into early 90s, 92, the grunge scene was going on in Seattle, and there was, you know, there's always shit going on in the world that needs our attention, you know? There are always things that need it, but... At that time, I remember there were tremendous protests taking place all the time. I remember camping out in Fresno State because they had laid off teachers that semester, which seems perennial. And then, but they'd done it at the same time where President Welty, who's still the president of Fresno State, was putting in $4,000 worth of stained glass windows in the mansion, in the bathroom of the mansion that he gets to live in. I remember thinking that was obscene, you know? But maybe the obscenity is that now, with so much on the plate, you know, I don't see anything happening. Why don't some of you get like a casket and do like the Vietnam era protests did and write down the names of all those who've died, right? And fill the casket with the names, which is sad because it's possible. And then carry it through the streets of Los Angeles, you know? Or somewhere, deliver it to somebody, you know? Maybe deliver it to your own doorstep. Deliver it to my doorstep, you know? Something, but do something, you know? We don't live in a time where we can't be doing something. I think maybe there's a great pessimism in this country. I don't think it's apathy at all. I think people feel like if I go out and stand on a street corner, I'm just gonna look like a jackass. A couple people honk, people flip me off, and that's it. I'll waste my time. But if you look at history, that's not true. Those things accumulate, and they create political will that make things happen. You know. I'll read, how about one more poem, do you think? It's a long one, is that okay? I won't get in trouble?
All right.
I forgot to ask if you had any fresh fruit so you could, or maybe a shoe, right? President Jalal Talabani said, "This will leave a scar in our souls." And what he was talking about, do you remember the day in Iraq when 1,000 people died and not a single shot was fired? Right? I rarely meet people who remember this day. Not a single shot, but 1,000 people died. And it wasn't by natural causes, you know? So I'll read this poem, see if it brings something back to mind. It's called the Alalima Bridge. With apologies for all the pronunciations in here that I'm not getting correct. They fall from the bridge into the Tigris. They fall from railings or tumble down, shoved by panic, by those in the crushing weight behind them, mothers with children, 70-year-old men clawing at the blue and empty sky, which is too beautiful. Some focus on the bridge work as they fall, grasp the invisible rope which slips through their fingers. Some palm heel the air beneath them, pressing down as their children swim in the oxygen beside them, lives blurring with no time to make sense. Some so close to shore they smash against the rocks. The pregnant woman who twists in a corkscrew of air, flipping upside down, the world upended, her black dress a funeral banner rippling in the wind, her child never given a name. They fall beside Shatha and Kantara and Sabin, Hakim, Askari, and Gabir, unraveling years and memory, struggling to keep heads above water, the hard shock sweeping them downstream as Askari fights to gain the shoreline where emerald flags furl in sunlight, and onlookers wave frantic arms at Gabir, who holds the body of a dead child he doesn't know. And it is only 11:30 a.m., and this is how we die, he thinks, on a day as beautiful as this. And Shatha, who feels the river's cold hands pulling her under, remembers once loving the orange flowers opening on the hillsides of Mosul, how she lay under slow clouds drifting in history's bright catalog. They fall with 500-pound bombs and mortars, laser-guided munitions directing the German Luftwaffe from 1941, Iraqi jets and airmen from the Six-Day War, the Battle of Karbala, the 1 million who died fighting Iran, and Alexander the Great falls, and King Faisal, and the Israeli F-16s that bombed the reactor in 81, and the Stella the Vultures comes crumbling, the Tower of Samarra, the walled ruins of Nineveh, the Babylonians and Sumerians and Assyrians join them, falling from the bridge with Ibn Khaldun's torn pages, the Muqaddimah, that classic Islamic history of the world. And Scheherazade falls too, worn out, exhausted from her life-saving work, made speechless by the scale of war, and Ali Baba with an AK-47 beside her. Whiskey and vodka, pirated Eastern European porn videos, the kids hawked to soldiers, the freaky, they call it, and foil-wrapped packages of heroin, thrown to the river. The year 1956 slides under, along with 49 and 31 and 17, the month of October, the months of June, July, and August, the many months to follow. Each day's exquisite light. The snowfall in Mosul, the photographs a family took of children rolling snowballs, throwing them before licking the pink cold from their fingertips. Years unravel like filaments of straw, bleached gold and given to the water. 1967 and 1972, 2001 and 2002. What will we remember? What will we say of these? It awakens the dead from the year 1258, who cannot believe what is happening here. Not a shot fired. The internalized panic deeply set by years of warfare, the siege and adrenaline always at the surface, prepared. The dead from the year 1258 read from the ancient scrolls cast into the river from the House of Wisdom, the eulogies of nations given water's swift erasure. And the dead watch as they are swept downstream, witness to the soft, tender lips of the river fish who kiss the calves and fingertips of these newly dead, curious to see how lifeless bodies stare hard into the dark envelopment, hands waving to the far shore. The jinn awaken from their slumber to watch the dead pass by, one fixed with an odd smile, the drawn-out vowel of a word left unfinished. And they want to hold these dead close and tight, the lungs' last reserve given as a whisper of bubbles for the ear held up to it. The jinn swim to reach the bony ankles of Sabine, the muscled Askari, clasping them to stop them from this tragic undertaking. And some are nearly saved by others diving in to rescue the terrified and the stunned, but drown under a woman's soaked abaya. And the Tigris is filling with the dead, filling with bricks from Abu Ghraib, burning vehicles pushed from Highway 1, with rebar, stone, metal, with rubble from the mosque bombed in Samarra, guard towers and razor wire imprisoning Tikrit. It fills with a pipeline of money, marketplace bombs, roadside bombs, vehicle-driven bombs, and the bombs people make of themselves. Gilgamesh can do nothing. Knows that each life is the world dying anew. Each body, the deep pool of currents below, lost. And lost within each, the subtle, the sublime, the horrific, the mundane, the tragic, the humorous, and the erotic, lost. Unstudied in textbooks, courses on mathematics, the equations quantifying fear, or the stoppage of time this eternal moment creates, unwritten history, forgotten in American hallways, but still, give them flowers from the hills, flowers from the Shanidar cave, where mourning has a long history, where someone in the last ice age gathered a bouquet. Give daisies and hyacinths to this impossible moment, flowers to stand for the lips unable to kiss them, each in their own bright beauty, flowers that may light the darkness as they march deeper into the earth. Thank you very much.
right. Now we get to talk a little bit here, right?
Well, it seems like we should almost just follow that with a breath, a silence. Thank you, Brian. I've been reading these, you know, one hears them, one reads them on the page and sees them on the page and hears them in your head, and it's so different to hear them embodied with your voice. Thank you so much.
They feel different too.
Feel different too. How does it feel like to read the ones that you haven't read for a while?
Well, some of them I hadn't read ever. I don't think I've ever read Green Alexandrian, for example, in front of a person. You know, I read them to the night of Texas, the Texas night. You know, so to owls and insects and stuff. But it's different when people are looking back at you, because then Hemingway's. I don't know if you guys know, but Hemingway's bullshit detector. He says it's a part of the apparatus that writers have to have, that each poem demands that it be recalibrated for it. But it felt okay.
It felt
more than I thought it would. I was kind of dreading earlier. I think that detector is going to ding, 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 ding.
Well, you know, I'm listening to this not, of course, as a vet, having no experience of war, but as a, you know, as a reader and as a daughter of a vet, you know, and a daughter of a vet who... spent 165 days of consecutive combat and, you know, never mentioned it. You know, never. That was the one taboo in our house. You could not talk about it. So I was very curious about, you know, the culture in which you grew up with your father and grandfather, both vets, and wondered if you could talk about their influence on you and your decision to become a soldier.
Sure. I mean, there's a wide variety of things I could go with that. I'll probably just sort of ramble a bit and then sort of bring me back. But...
back, Brian.
Right? Because I can be very tangential. I think my grandfather and my uncle and my dad, who's my, I guess he would say he's technically my stepfather, and then my biological father, my dad, who's in the Navy. The father who raised me was, he was a Russian linguist who would fly over Russian airspace in the late 60s. If he died because he'd be shot down by a MiG, then it would be a training accident back home. That's how his family would be notified. And for decades, he was obliged not to talk about his service. He couldn't because it was classified. He wasn't supposed to talk to anybody about it. And so he didn't share that with us either.
So while you were growing up, he was doing this work?
He had done it. Before, in the late 60s. I was born in 67. So it was before my time. But my grandfather was on the first wave of the beaches of Guam as a Marine. He lied about his age at 17 and joined the military. He sat in a chair most of my childhood in his home, and westerns would be on at the time. I remember in the early 70s and into the mid 70s, there were always westerns, you know, which means we were out kicking Native Americans' asses out in somewhere in the movie, right? Because they were the other, and then the other was replaced with The Empire Strikes Back and Star Wars, so it shifted there. Those were the things that were on the screen as I'd go over to visit and, you know, lay down on the floor and watch TV while he would sit there and be quiet. The rest of the family would talk, and then he would go out every now and then, 20, 30 minutes, go out to the woodshed, take a little sip, come back and sit down, and that was how he sort of got through. He stopped drinking now, but this last week, he got his first... I guess series of medications to deal with PTSD. Mm. You know?
Did he tell you war stories?
No. He told me just as my dad did, just as everyone in my family did. They told me the stories that exist on the perimeter of war. Mm. He told me about the oceans. They told me about islands where there wasn't combat. They told me about places they'd eaten, things they'd seen. They didn't talk about combat.
So they weren't transmitting to you that war was a great adventure. I mean, that wasn't an enticement of any kind.
There was still the idea of going somewhere. And the difficult thing, and this is something I've been trying to work out in my mind, especially this last year or so, as I was doing the Amy Lowell, as I was traveling to different countries where I was in Portugal at one point, and you could see, I could see there was the Angola Cafe. And I was like, oh, that's interesting, right? Intriguing, the Angola Cafe, and I sat down and talked with some people, and you'd start to find out their war stories, talking about Angola and their connections, and it just seemed like my family, in order for me to become, if I go back to deep into the subconscious, my formation as a man, looking at the men in my family, and a couple of the women also served in uniform as well, so in order to become like those I revered, I say in the past tense, and still continue to revere and love, you know, In order to be like them, in a sense, I have to do what America does once every generation, at least in a large-scale way, but also in multiple small ways, too, is go somewhere very far away, usually stomp on some small country, and then some difficult thing happens there, and then they come back, and they don't talk about it with the rest of us.
But Brian,
which is what happened to my family.
That's what happened to your family?
But so the only way for me to become like the people I revere is to do what they have done.
But first, you studied poetry.
I did.
So, I mean, I was surprised when I read that in your biography because I thought, well, you know, you had gone in the army and then you came out and you studied. But no, you were very seriously studying poetry so that you were writing some of these poems actually during combat. Is that correct? Or during service?
Well, here at Bullet, I wrote while I was in Iraq.
Right.
I wrote 2 or 3 poems the month I came back. I actually wrote 10 or 15 poems the month I came back. Can't remember exactly. I'd have to look in the notebooks, but 2 or 3 that are in there were written that month. But everything else is written while I was there, and then the second book is written
after
once I've been home.
And you know, I think I was thinking about my father writing my mom all these letters from the Philippines, and how, in a sense, you know, he kind of thought of this as this kind of soul saving, life saving endeavor. Writing. I mean, that's what kind of. Yeah. And did poetry fill that function for you when you were there?
Not at all. Not at all. It didn't get anything off my chest at all. Mm. Now, I would say like maybe, well, I don't know, if you ask me 10 years from now, maybe I'd be able to see in a clear light because it's still fairly fresh, you know. But at the time, and it feels overly dramatic to kind of say, but like today's Thursday, and if I'm in Iraq, then I could be dead on Monday, or I might be horribly maimed or something, you know. So the pressure that was pushing me to write those poems didn't go away. It was still there. And it's the only time I've ever experienced that kind of writing where it felt like, okay, I have 20 minutes to write. What am I going to put in this notebook? You know, and mostly it wasn't poetry, mostly journal entries of what had happened during the day. And if you look at them, what you'll see is someone very tired oftentimes where the writing is on top of lines, you know, that kind of thing. And sometimes diagrams is from a bird's eye view looking at an ambush or something on a street where people were, like maybe what we should not do next time kind of thing. And then sometimes poems would come out, a few lines at a time, and then I would transfer those into a different notebook once they started showing up, which I have to go back and find out when that was, because I don't remember when they started showing up, but it was after a few weeks at least. And then I would fill the other notebook, the journal notebooks, and then I'd mail them home to my parents, and that was a way of, that was sort of this mailed conversation that was different than the telephone conversations I would have when I'd call them on the phone. I was like, yeah, well, we're doing great, yeah, we're doing fine, everything's, you know, pretty good. And then I give them these notebooks where they can, you know.
Were you writing some of the poems, like the poem that you read about, you know, Don't Call Me a Haji? I was thinking about, because, you know, through the poems, you're like building, you know, they build empathy for the other. And it seems like what's happening in the war zone is that's the exact opposite. It's tearing down your empathy so that you can actually be in an adversarial situation. So they seem like that would be an interesting tension or an uncomfortable tension, was it?
Yeah, but I think when moments of survival happened, like when shit hit the fan or however you want to say it, when somebody shot at you, then, because we would often walk through the streets of Mosul, for example, and because there's no front line, so you don't know where to go to fight the person you've been sent to go fight. So we would, it was at least a twofold mission. One is to walk through the streets so that the Iraqi people that are there, living there, hopefully would see us and feel safer, like the way you might with the police officer at the door, right? You're like, oh, there's somebody there he's there to take care of us if some problem comes up, you know? That's the hope on the one side. The other side was that we were going out there because there isn't a front line, so you have to walk until someone shoots at you, and then you know, oh, that's the person, right? Then we have to deal with, this is who we're here to deal with, you know? And then there was, in that instant, the empathy and all that, it became just a chaotic moment there. And then later, if you went back to a base, then you could kind of think through, like, why, which is something I've been thinking for years, for example, about one guy who fired an RPG at me across a traffic circle, and it hit the tail right behind me in the vehicle and knocked me down in the hatch. It didn't hurt me at all, but scared the shit out of me, to be honest, too. And that's putting it mildly, actually. But I think about that guy sometimes, and I've actually been writing a long piece about that moment, sort of the philosophy of that moment, because there's a lot there that connects me to him, but I've never met him, you know? Could I ever break bread? And that seems like the hope, right? That someday maybe he and I could sit across the table and share these cups of, share this water that's in this pitcher.
Like some of the Vietnam vets going back, you know, to kind of build a kind of sense of reconciliation, and with themselves as well in Vietnam. In his study, there's a great study of war narratives by Samuel Hines, Soldier's Tale. I don't know if you're familiar with it. It's called Bearing Witness to Modern War, and he's talking about how war narratives basically are about three things: the things men and now women do in war, the things war does to them, and the interchanges that happen to you because of war. And he talks about this need for distance. You know, he says most war memoirs come late in life to perceive the changes that war has made. They require this passage of time to look back. Can you talk about how the writing changes as you get further from the experience? I mean, I noticed in Phantom Noise, there is more distance, but at the same time, the war is intruding all, you know, even in a more kind of, when you read the Lowe's Home Improvement, I mean, it's around you in so many instances. The landscape is following you home.
You know, if I look at the two books, and if I try and sort of step out of myself for a moment, look at the two, what I see as a soldier in the first one, it's odd because I'll show you if you haven't seen it, but that's a photograph of me on the cover. But what's odd about this, kind of ironic, because I'm really not in this book much. It's mostly about things happening around me. And it seemed like poetry was a way to preserve. It wasn't a cathartic thing, but it seemed very important to remember what had happened. And so that seemed like part of the process.
And show that cover, too. Yeah, it's important.
And then this book, that's in a painting from an Iraqi painter who lives in Baghdad. And this book, it's more about me. The eye shows up more. You can see it in the pronoun, but it really is closer to my own experience.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm hoping it's translatable or it crosses over the divide between writer and reader and that kind of thing.
Absolutely.
But I think the psychological aspects that I have to deal with, and I think hopefully if this book is useful at all, maybe for those who have a similar experience, they might see that other people have this kind of thing going on or they think like this. And I know it's not just this war, you know, and it's not only for those who carry a weapon in their hands. It might be those who've had people carry weapons against them, for example, you know.
I think that's how, you know, when Maxine Hong Kingston, and she's talking about the veterans of war, veterans of peace, she includes many, many people in that,
right,
you know, under
right.
that umbrella who've, right. you know, been through all kinds of different trauma. But I was thinking
Do you mind if I say one thing?
Yeah, go.
Because we usually say, I said PTSD with my grandfather, but what was it called during...
Shell shock.
Shell shock? What was it before that?
Combat fatigue.
Battle fatigue, combat fatigue. What was it? Do you guys know in the American Civil War? It used to be called a soldier's heart.
That's right.
Yeah. And what you were just saying, I was thinking it would be nice if we could find a phrase along the lines of Maxine Hong Kingston, what you're saying, that encompassed the family as well and those others who
yes,
are connected.
Yes.
But that idea, is something in that I think is very useful, much more so than an acronym, you know.
That's a very good point. That's a very good point.
I didn't mean to interrupt you.
I'm going to not go through. I've had too many questions because I'm going to give the audience a chance to ask questions too. But I love the way in which in the poems, well, both Arabic history and the history of the Middle East, when you're when you read the bridge poem, were you aware when you were there? Was it very present for you, that sense of history? Were you?
Oh yeah.
You could feel it all the time.
Yeah. Well, many times, not all the time, because sometimes. It's almost a persona thing. So one of the three, what were the three things that you'd said that
the things men and now, you know I just say he
women.
Says the things men do in war, the thing war does to them, and the interchanges. What happened to me?
And that what happened to me, I think, starts before military service, during, and after. And there are the changes of name that you can see on their name tapes, and the way I became Sergeant Turner, or Sergeant T. That was my persona in the military. For 7 years, 1 month, and 29 days, I was someone different than Brian. In fact, my boss, when we came back in that month right after I went to the rave party and I was writing a couple
Energizer
more poems.
Energizer Bunny.
But he knew I wasn't staying in the military. I was getting out. And he said, I know you're getting out, so just show up in the morning to your PT and then go figure out who Brian is, you know, that kind of thing. And now I've wandered off the set. That's my tangential.
You know, Hines also talks about how no soldier can see the whole picture of any war going on because everyone's just, you know, in their own slice of it. I mean, you're seeing what you're seeing. And but part of what the war narratives are doing are to show us, those of us who've never been to war, how unfamiliar war is, how unfamiliar and desolate its ordinary scenes are. And I was really struck with that. You know, there's many strange and amazing images in your book that are very jarring to someone who has no experience of that. One that particularly struck me was this image of you writing with a Sharpie on someone who's blindfolded, right? Yeah.
And that used to have to put the sandbags over them to blindfold them. And that's after Abu Ghraib, we were ordered not to do that because it became iconic with torture, right? So then we had a new way, which is this roll of engineer tape, which is a white, very thin material. But you can't see through it. It's not tape, though. It's not sticky or tacky. And we would use that to blindfold them. And because it was easy to write on it, or when we had basically these, you know, sandbags over the heads, we would take, what do you call that, that silver tape that everybody uses?
Duct tape.
Yeah, because it's for everything, right? We'd take duct tape and put that around to hold, kind of hold it in place, and we'd mark on there as well because there's a way of marking prisoners so that you know when you hand them off to another unit who they are with the depositions that have to be filled out like a police report kind of thing.
And that's the poem called Discotheque, and the discotheque was actually the interrogation center, is that
right? It was, on Mosul, on the airbase there, near Mosul, there's an airbase. And when we went, we would go out many nights and we would raid houses and bring back prisoners. And then when we would come in, it might be dawn by this time or something. Who knows how many hours had gone by. We'd be exhausted. But I'd been a teacher before. They called me Sergeant T, sometimes the professor, because I'd taught classes before. So I could write a sentence, right? So me and my boss, he would always just say, hey, professor, let's go in. The two of us would go in with the prisoners. The rest of the guys would sleep in the vehicle. And we would, I'd have to write depositions and sort of basically frame their guilt. And then they would be given to the MPs, who would then in turn start to interrogate them. And if they didn't yield information or intelligence, then they'd often be sent down to Abu Ghraib to get the intelligence from them. Because if you just work hard enough, you can make them talk. These are the guilty ones, you know? And if you read Tony Lugaranis' book, Fear Up Harsh, An Army Interrogator's Dark Descent into Torture, which... it's clunky in its prose, to be honest, and I'm not being an elitist, you know, writer kind of thing. I mean, it's a little clunky. He did it with a ghostwriter. I think it could have been done better. But I found three quarters of the way through, I realized that he wasn't talking about some figurative soldier like me. He was actually talking about me. Mm. And I learned this on a stage like this in Galway, Ireland, as I interviewed him and we were talking. And boy, I'd read the book right before, and I got three quarters of the way in, and I realized, shit, you know? And it was an interesting conversation because next to that, well, across this little dirt road on this base, it was a little PX where you could go and get CDs and books and things like that. And then next to the MP shack and these sort of holding pens for humans, you know, they'd been swept up into the machine. Next to that was a large Connex. It looked sort of like a rail car you'd see on the railroad, on the trains. And there was a big, huge, there was these poles jutting up from the ground with a big camo net covering over it, and they painted on this thing, the discotheque. And I remember thinking, and a pogue in military terms is anyone who stays back in the base, or is in Vietnam times, they might have said in the rear with the gear, or their rear D, or, you know, they might have some maybe more colorful phrases for that. We would call them pogues. So they weren't real soldiers like us, right? You know, it was just kind of silly, but that's the way the services work. Mm-hmm. But I remember thinking, those fucking pogues, man, they have a discotheque, they call it. They probably go in there and drink tea, and I could hear music coming out of it. So I thought, they get to chill out and listen to music? But that wasn't what was happening, of course, right? There was torture going. That was sound torture. That was where they were breaking people.
Yeah, and that background is kind of in the back of that poem.
Yeah. Could you mind if there's one thing I was going to say about language and the actual landscape that I think might be important? Do you mind?
Please.
And it's getting back to your question before, because I remember what I wanted to say was I remember being on the shores of the Tigris River in the pre-dawn darkness and looking across the river. I've been in country long enough now that I've heard bullets go off and we don't freak out anymore, and everybody's on the radio calling, oh, we got gunshots, we got shots fired, all this freaking out kind of thing. It's over there, it's like three football fields away across the river. If you've been a river when it's going by real dark and slow and you can't quite see it, but you can sort of feel its presence, It was sort of like that, a very wide river. And on the far side, it's a big city, 1.7 million people. So the ambient lights of the city backlit the far skyline. And I could see, I heard a boom, brr, pop, 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 you know, over there. But it's like, well, I don't even call it up. I don't even say it to the guy next to me. We just sort of look, you know. I remember this very clearly because I remember thinking, oh, it's probably a police station that's been hit over there or a little checkpoint as a drive-by, maybe a hand grenade and a couple shots or something. They're driving off. But as I was looking, I saw this odd-shaped building. You know how buildings always have rectangular, square kind of looks to them in the skyline? There was one that was different. And it's because those are the castle ruins of Salah al-Din, the person who is famous there for driving out, right, the Christian invaders, the Crusaders. And then I was there at the same time, and the thought came through my head that said, you know, that kind of history. I had a president say, remember this? This crusade, this war on terror is going to last a while, unquote. But I have to stand up for a second because Imagine, and here it was like a stupid gaffe, right? It was like, oh, and it played in the news for about 2 weeks and then next slide, right? But in Iraq, people don't forget this stuff, you know? Because it's like, imagine an American president. He's sort of like, you know, I'm going to stand up because this maybe is more of how it feels.
When he says, this crusade, what is he implying? This crusade?
Yeah.
He implies like, remember the other ones? Those are pretty kick-ass, right? Remember those? This crusade, this war on terror, is going to last a while. You know? And yes, he kept his promise. He kept our promise.
Yeah, it's connecting it to the whole mythological idea that this is the right war. This is the
right.
You know, that goes on. Yeah. Well,
I believe it was a mistake on his part. I mean, more than I think he's. I just don't think he has command of his thoughts. But at the same time,
there's empathy for you.
But I mean, to kind of be fair to him, you know, as a human being, I just don't think he really has it. You know, but we as a nation, we have so much work to do to undo the power of not only what we've done physically, but even intellectually. You know what I mean?
Well, that leads to. I think I'll just have this be my last question. I'll ask you as. You know, you've come home from war. You've seen so many other people come home from war. And I'm thinking about, you know, that wonderful phrase of William James. You know, the moral equivalent of war. I mean, do you think there can be another way for young men to go through a rite of passage? What do you think those are that we could?
Young men and women. I tell them because I was thinking about. You know, I went to a prison in Ireland. I visited Castlereagh Prison. I remember right when I walked in. The door shut, whoom, and I heard the sound. And I looked back, and they have these tall walls, right? And there's a tower up there, and there's wire along. And I remember thinking, oh, you know, it reminded me immediately of being in the military, you know? I mean, I didn't get to carry a gun, and the guns were facing inwards, whereas they'd be outwards, but it was the same thing. And the reason I say that is because there's an allure and a seductiveness, and I worry about the poems as well, playing into this sometimes, especially with each generation as they come up, war poetry, war movies, war novels. They have this sort of pull to them. I tell them, I was like, instead of that, go to college for 4 years, which a lot of them don't want to hear. And I say, I would say do both, but go get a paramedics license, for example. Do that. And then go to another country, you know, maybe sub-Saharan Africa or something.
Yes.
Oh my God, you will experience adventure, you know? Three people in a Land Rover driving out in the middle of the desert, going to some place, they don't speak the language, they've got to deliver some stuff that these people do not have and they need, you know? I mean, we're talking real stuff here. I mean, real adventure, if you want to use that word, or, you know, I mean, that might be the right word for...
Adventure, yes.
Adventure, yeah, absolutely. And also... you know, getting out in the world and being a part of something larger than themselves and living beyond, which is something I think a lot. The hard part, though, is trying to help or encourage people to think that way rather than feeling like maybe they're missing the wide sweep of history. I think a lot of people join the military, especially in times of war, because they just don't want to miss it. They might not believe in it at all or not really want to take part in it, but I know this might sound odd, but they just don't want to miss it, seeing it. And see, there's some psychological thing there that it's hard for me to sort of encourage them, although a few people seem to be interested in that other possibilities like that. But I would encourage also the State Department And it doesn't, it's not a sexy sounding job, but again, you get to go somewhere, you travel in different, you have different assignments in different countries. You actually get to go in and sit down and eat and try out the food, listen to the music.
And break the bread with the people that you didn't, right?
Yeah, and that's the hard, we've been going around the world with guns for quite a while now. And it seems like we need a new way. The poet Bruce Weigel, he said, going back to what you'd said earlier, he was a Vietnam era poet. He's a poet now. I shouldn't say that. He writes amazing poetry now. I'm going to read with him in Guggenheim Museum in New York next month. But he said that when he went back to Vietnam and met his counterparts there, that one of them said this. And he said, you know, you Americans are strange because first you send your guns and your tanks, then you send your poets. You know?
So. Thank you, Brian.
Can I read one poem to sort of?
Yeah,
I'm
going to have. We're going to talk, and then we're going to have you end.
Okay,
with
I wanted to. I'm eager.
We have time for. We had a nice. Well, how about right back there? First that one, and then that gentleman right there.
As a soldier, do you feel there was anything positive from going into Iraq? And my second question is, seeing all that death, what is your feeling when a Shiite blows up a Christian church or another Sunni?
I was in Salt Lake City about a month and a half ago, and I remember seeing the newspaper that day was put, you know, when you're in the hotel and they'll put it by the door, so you open up and it had a picture of some Iraqi Kurdish soldiers sort of walking through the streets, and it looked like they were really relaxed, like they didn't, you know, they weren't in a dangerous place. They had that look. You know, most soldiers, when you know it's dangerous, you'll see them with the weapon. They might have their hands on the weapon, and then it gets a little closer up, and then when you know it's really dangerous, they patrol the streets sort of walking like this, just looking over the tops of their weapons. So that you can almost see it even imagistically. And the headline, I forget what it was, I wish I could remember it, but it said something like, you know, it had to do with winning. It used the word winning, and it said there have been some, you know, winning moments in the war, and it talked about the Kurdish sort of the reporter seemed to be trying to find a way to find victory or a win, which to me is absurd. Like, I don't even know how you use those words with war. There's only, like, the limit of loss, or, like, trying to find some way to stop the bleeding. You know what I mean? The word winning has nothing to do with it. It's a complete failure when someone pulls the trigger, you know? Do you know what I mean? So it's hard for me to find any, to be honest, to find any redeeming thing that's happened other than some of the amazing fact that people in Baghdad are still going to work and they're still having children. I think that's how courageous must it be to have a child in a time of war, you know? Like, how much hope must they have to be able to do that? You know, it impresses me beyond my lexicon, you know? The other question you had, I'm starting to fade on now.
Let's go to the next one just so we can get some.
Maybe
more.
Afterwards, if we'll talk after.
Talk in the lobby.
Thank you very much for your service and your sacrifice. I would like to know how you feel about Dick Cheney, George Bush, and the rest of the Chicken Hawks.
Well, I was going to read a poem tonight that has to do very much with that. It was called "Sleeping in Dick Cheney's Bed."
It's a great poem.
It's in the second book. Because I stayed at the U.S. Air Force Academy, and I slept in the bed where he slept. And I told the people there, I said, I got to write a poem about this, because, you know. And they invited me back a year later, so I guess we're doing all right, you know. But when in that poem, I very much point the finger at Dick Cheney, for example, and it's sleeping, but the idea of sleeping in Dick Cheney's bed, at the very end of the poem, it says, basically the long lines of, like, how is it that I'm able to sleep? And then the night is a perfection of sleep, it says in the very end. How are we all able to go to sleep and wake up refreshed? We are a nation of torturers. We live in a country where the president that I admire very much, I've voted for him, and I back him on most things, to be honest, you know. But there are a couple things I quibble with, and some things I more than quibble with. And one is the idea that we live in a nation very much divided. You know, it's very difficult. You go in the airports and you see the books now say things like patriots or pinheads. It's gotten to that point where, you know, you're either like really with us or you're just an idiot, you know? That's where we've gotten. And I guess the reason I have a problem with it is that I have to realize the culpability within myself with torture. And I think we have to have that conversation in this country. So I would argue with President Obama on that. I don't think, even though it is difficult, it's very difficult, it will create partisan divide more. But we live in a time of torture. We talk about the debt, for example, right? And some people talk about the debt and they'll say, we're going to put this on our grandchildren. Well, do we do the same with the discussion of torture? We'll let them decide what was right and what was wrong, what we should have done. Do you know what I mean? When I talked about the people with the leash, I mean, I said my people, these people. With that, I say I was most culpable. I wore the uniform. I was a part of it. I took them into the chamber and gave them to the torturer. My hands are on those depositions that said, this person did that, you know? So I hold myself accountable. And if there are ever war crimes, as difficult as that would be for me to do, I would have to, if I shirked my duty in that, I would just be living my life as a lie, but I would have to show up for those. And I think Dick Cheney should too. Because he definitely was a major part in that. Donald Rumsfeld, who shook Saddam Hussein, as we gave him a weapons of mass destruction program. We gave him, our scientists helped them, we gave them chemical weapons. It's just a fraud that we as American people didn't yell louder. We yelled very loud as a people, but not loud enough. And the numbers should have been far more. They preyed on the Capitol. The small coterie of people within the White House preyed on the fear of 9/11. They knew. That's why we had to go in 2003, because if they waited one more season, there might not be enough political will from the fear that was still invested in within us, or existent within us, that we might not go into Iraq at that time. It goes against the fundamental principles of warfare, which is find them, fix them, fuck them. Find them, shoot at them, find them. Oh, there's the enemy, right? Geopolitical, well, we have a president that says, axis of evil. Okay. Fix them, shoot at them in small squad tactics. You shoot at somebody well enough, they'll keep their head down, right? I'll hide behind this table, flip it over, try and hide behind it or something. If you shoot well enough, I can't move from there. I'm fixed. Now I can maneuver against them. A person who has good command on the battlefield knows that when they have a fixed enemy and they can maneuver, just to take a second, or in geopolitical terms, maybe months or all the years of the sanctions that we had on Iraq, right? They're fixed. They're not going anywhere. Why do we have to go right now? Because if you go too soon, you can, more casualties will take place, more trauma, more pain, more expenditure of all of our wealth, meaning soul, spirit, body. So in my mind, that's before I went to Iraq, that was in my mind. I thought, this just doesn't smell right. And I started looking at the people who were in power who were saying we had to do these things, as we should still do, as we should always do, as I should have done better. Yeah.
Oh, thank you, Brian.
Thank you. Sorry, I get on our little rant.
No, it's okay. I'm going to bring it to a close so you'll have time to talk to Brian in the lobby. But, you know, in the poem, the incredible bridge poem that you read, that's like a Bosch or a Bruegel painting, you talk about Scheherazade falling too, and you call her worn out, exhausted from her life-saving work, made speechless by the scale of war. And I just want to say that we are so fortunate that you came through this not speechless, and that you are here to bear witness. And we are very honored to have you here, and thank you. And I know you want to end with a poem by, you want to reread Amichai?
I would like to, yeah. Do you guys mind a poem that's not mine?
That's a great way to end.
Yeah. And plus, maybe it'll, if you haven't read his work, then hopefully it'll encourage you to do so. And if I read it poorly, then read his work anyways, because trust me, it's good. But this is called The Diameter of the Bomb. The diameter of the bomb was 30 centimeters, and the diameter of its effective range about 7 meters, with 4 dead and 11 wounded. And around these, in a larger circle of pain and time, 2 hospitals are scattered and 1 graveyard. But the young woman who was buried in the city she came from, at a distance of more than 100 kilometers, enlarges the circle considerably. And the solitary man mourning her death at the distant shores of a country far across the sea includes the entire world in the circle. And I won't even mention the howling of orphans that reaches up to the throne of God and beyond, making a circle with no end and no God. That's Yehuda Amichai. So if you clap for anyone, let's clap for Yehuda, because that's funny.
And thank you, Brian. Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.